The Aurelian. 1. Luring aside one of the trolley car numbers, the street started at the corner of a crowded avenue. For a long time it crept on in obscurity, with no shop windows or any such joys. Then came a small square, 4 benches, a bed of pansies, round which the trolley steered with rasping disapproval. Here the street changed its name, and a new life began. Along the right side, shops appeared, a fruiterer's with vivid pyramids of oranges, a tobacconist's with the picture of a voluptuous Turk, a delicatessen with fat brown and gray coils of sausages, and then, all of a sudden, a butterfly store. At night, and especially when it was damp, with the asphalt shining like the back of a seal, passers-by would stop for a second before that symbol of fair weather. The insects on exhibit were huge and gorgeous. People would say to themselves, "What colors! Amazing!" and plod on through the drizzle. Eyed wings wide open in wonder, shimmering blue satin, black magic, these lingered for a while, floating in one's vision, until one boarded the trolley or bought a newspaper. And, just because they were together with the butterflies, a few other objects would remain in one's memory. A globe, pencils, and a monkey's skull on a pile of copybooks. As the street blinked and ran on, there followed again a succession of ordinary shops, soap, coal, bread, with another pause at the corner where there was a small bar. The bartender, a dashing fellow in a starched collar and green sweater, was deft at shaving off with one stroke the foam topping a glass under the beer tap. He also had a well-earned reputation as a wit. Every night, at a round table by the window, the fruiterer, the baker, an unemployed man, and the bartender's first cousin played cards with great gusto. As the winner of the current stake immediately ordered 4 drinks, none of the players could ever get rich. On Saturdays, at an adjacent table, there would sit a flabby elderly man with a florid face, lank hair, and a grayish mustache, carelessly clipped. When he appeared, the players greeted him noisily without looking up from their cards. He invariably ordered rum, filled his pipe, and gazed at the game with pink-rimmed, watery eyes. The left eyelid drooped slightly. Occasionally, someone turned to him and asked how his shop was doing. He would be slow to answer and often did not answer at all. If the bartender's daughter, a pretty freckled girl in a polka-dotted frock, happened to pass close enough, he had a go at her elusive hip, and whether the slap succeeded or not, his gloomy expression never changed, although the veins on his temple grew purple. My host very humorously called him Herr Professor. "Well, how is the Herr Professor tonight?" he would ask, coming over to him, and the man would ponder for some time in silence, and then with a wet underlip pushing out from under the pipe like that of a feeding elephant, he would answer something neither funny nor polite. The bartender would counter briskly, which made the players at the next table, though seemingly absorbed in their cards, rock with ugly glee. The man wore a roomy gray suit with great exaggeration of the vest motif, and when the cuckoo popped out of the clock, he ponderously extracted a thick silver watch and gazed at it askance, holding it in the palm of his hand and squinting because of the smoke. Punctually at 11 he knocked out his pipe, paid for his rum, and after extending a flaccid hand to anyone who might choose to shake it, silently left. He walked awkwardly, with a slight limp. His legs seemed too thin for his body. Just before the window of his shop he turned into a passage where there was a door on the right with a brass plate, Paul Pilgrim. This door led into his tiny, dingy apartment, which could also be reached by an inner corridor at the back of the shop. Eleanor was usually asleep when he came home on those festive nights. Half a dozen faded photographs of the same clumsy ship, taken from different angles, and of a palm tree that looked as bleak as if it were growing on Helgoland, hung in black frames above the double bed. Muttering to himself, Pilgrim limped away into bulbless darkness with a lighted candle, came back with his suspenders dangling, and kept muttering while sitting on the edge of the bed, then slowly, painfully, taking off his shoes. His wife, half-waking, moaned into her pillow and offered to help him, and then, with a threatening rumble in his voice, he would tell her to keep quiet, and repeated that guttural "Ruhe" several times, more and more fiercely. After the stroke which had almost killed him some time ago, like a mountain falling upon him from behind just as he had bent toward his shoestrings, he now undressed reluctantly, growling until he got safely into bed, and then growling again if the faucet happened to drip in the adjoining kitchen. Eleanor would roll out of bed and totter into the kitchen and totter back with a dazed sigh, her small face wax pale and shiny, and the plastered corns on her feet showing from under her dismally long nightgown. They had married in 1905, almost a quarter of a century before, and were childless because Pilgrim had always thought that children would be merely a hindrance to the realization of what had been in his youth a delightfully exciting plan, but had now gradually become a dark, passionate obsession. He slept on his back with an old-fashioned nightcap coming down on his forehead. It was to all appearances the solid and sonorous sleep that might be expected in an elderly German shopkeeper, and one could readily suppose that his quilted torpor was entirely devoid of visions. But actually this churlish heavy man, who fed mainly on Erbswurst and boiled potatoes, placidly believing in his newspaper and quite ignorant of the world, insofar as his secret passion was not involved, dreamed of things that would have seemed utterly unintelligible to his wife or his neighbors. For Pilgrim belonged, or rather was meant to belong. Something, the place, the time, the man, had been ill-chosen to a special breed of dreamers, such dreamers as used to be called in the old days Aurelians, perhaps on account of those chrysalids, those jewels of nature which they loved to find hanging on fences above the dusty nettles of country lanes. On Sundays he drank his morning coffee in several sloppy sessions, and then went out for a walk with his wife, a slow, silent stroll which Eleanor looked forward to all week. On workdays he opened his shop as early as possible because of the children who passed by on their way to school, for lately he had been keeping school supplies in addition to his basic stock. Some small boy swinging his satchel and chewing a sandwich would slouch past the tobacconist's, where a certain brand of cigarettes offered airplane pictures, past the delicatessen, which rebuked one for having eaten that sandwich long before lunchtime, and then, remembering he wanted an eraser, would enter the next shop. Pilgrim would mumble something, sticking out his lower lip from under the stem of his pipe, and after a listless search, would plump down an open carton on the counter. The boy would feel and squeeze a virgin pale India rubber, would not find the sort he favored, and would leave without even noticing the principal wares in the store. "These modern children," Pilgrim would think with disgust, and he recalled his own boyhood. His father, a sailor, a rover, a bit of a rogue, married late in life a sallow-skinned, light-eyed Dutch girl, whom he brought from Java to Berlin, and opened a shop of exotic curios. Pilgrim could not remember now when, exactly, butterflies had begun to oust the stuffed birds of paradise, the stale talismans, the fans with dragons, and the like. But as a boy he already feverishly swapped specimens with collectors, and after his parents died butterflies reigned supreme in the dim little shop. Up to 1914 there were enough amateurs and professionals about to keep things going in a mild, very mild way. Later on, however, it became necessary to make concessions, a display case with the biography of the silkworm furnishing a transition to school supplies, just as in the old days pictures ignominiously composed of sparkling wings had probably been a first step toward lepidopterology. Now the window contained, apart from penholders, mainly showy insects, popular stars among butterflies, some of them set on plaster and framed, intended merely for ornamenting the home. In the shop itself, permeated with the pungent odor of a disinfectant, the real, the precious collections were kept. The whole place was littered with various cases, cartons, cigar boxes. Tall cabinets contained numerous glass-lidded drawers filled with ordered series of perfect specimens impeccably spread and labeled. A dusty old shield or something, last remnant of the original wares, stood in a dark corner. Now and then live stock would appear, loaded brown pupae with a symmetrical confluence of delicate lines and grooves on the thorax, showing how the rudimentary wings, feet, antennae, and proboscis were packed. If one touched such a pupa as it lay on its bed of moss, the tapering end of the segmented abdomen would start jerking this way and that like the swathed limbs of a baby. The pupae cost the Reichsmark a piece, and in due time yielded a limp, bedraggled, miraculously expanding moth. And sometimes other creatures would be temporarily on sale. Just then there happened to be a dozen lizards, natives of Majorca, cold, black, blue-bellied things, which Pilgrim fed on mealworms for the main course and grapes for dessert. 2. He had spent all his life in Berlin and its suburbs, had never traveled farther than Peacock Island on a neighboring lake. He was a first-class entomologist. Dr. Rebel of Vienna had named a certain rare moth Agrotis pilgrami, and Pilgrim himself had published several descriptions. His boxes contained most of the countries of the world, but all he had ever seen of it was the dull sand and pine scenery of an occasional Sunday trip, and he would be reminded of captures that had seemed to him so miraculous in his boyhood as he melancholically gazed at the familiar fauna about him, limited by a familiar landscape to which it corresponded as hopelessly as he to his street. From a roadside shrub he would pick up a large turquoise-green caterpillar with a china-blue horn on the last ring. There it lay quite stiff on the palm of his hand, and presently, with a sigh, he would put it back on its twig as if it were some dead trinket. Although once or twice he had had the chance to switch to a more profitable business, selling cloth, for instance, instead of moths, he stubbornly held on to his shop as the symbolic link between his dreary existence and the phantom of perfect happiness. What he craved for with a fierce, almost morbid intensity was himself to net the rarest butterflies of distant countries, to see them in flight with his own eyes, to stand waist-deep in lush grass and feel the follow-through of the swishing net, and then the furious throbbing of wings through a clutched fold of the gauze. Every year it seemed to him stranger that the year before he had not managed somehow to lay aside enough money for at least a fortnight's collecting trip abroad. But he had never been thrifty. Business had always been slack. There was always a gap somewhere. And even if luck did come his way now and then, something was sure to go wrong at the last moment. He had married, counting heavily on a share in his father-in-law's business, but a month later the man had died, leaving nothing but debts. Just before World War I, an unexpected deal brought a journey to Algeria so near that he even acquired a sun helmet. When all travel stopped, he still consoled himself with the hope that he might be sent to some exciting place as a soldier. But he was clumsy, sickly, not very young, and thus saw neither active service nor exotic lepidoptera. Then, after the war, when he had managed again to save a little money, for a week in Zermatt this time, the inflation suddenly turned his meager hoard into something less than the price of a trolley car ticket. After that he gave up trying. He grew more and more depressed as his passion grew stronger. When some entomological acquaintance happened to drop in, Pilgrim was only annoyed. That fellow, he would think, may be as learned as the late Dr. Staudinger, but he has no more imagination than a stamp collector. The glass-lidded trays over which both were bending gradually took up the whole counter, and the pipe in Pilgrim's sucking lips kept emitting a wistful squeak. Pensively he gazed at the serried rows of delicate insects, all alike to you or me, and now and then he tapped on the glass with a stubby forefinger, stressing some special rarity. "That's a curiously dark aberration," the learned visitor might say. "Eisner got one like that at an auction in London, but it was not so dark, and it cost him £14. Painfully sniffling with his extinguished pipe, Pilgrim would raise the box to the light, which made the shadows of the butterflies slip from beneath them across the papered bottom. Then he would put it down again, and working in his nails under the tight edges of the lid, would shake it loose with a jerk, and smoothly remove it. And Eisner's female was not so fresh, the visitor would add, and some eavesdroppers coming in for a copybook or a postage stamp might well wonder what on earth these two were talking about. Grunting, Pilgrim plucked at the gilded head of the black pin upon which this silky little creature was crucified, and took the specimen out of the box. Turning it this way and that, he peered at the label pinned under the body. "Yes, Tatsien Lu, East Tibet," he read. "Taken by the native collectors of Father Dejean," which sounded almost like Prester John, and he would stick the butterfly back again, right into the same pinhole. His motions seemed casual, even careless, but this was the unerring nonchalance of the specialist. The pin with the precious insect and Pilgrim's fat fingers were the correlated parts of one and the same flawless machine. It might happen, however, that some open box, having been brushed by the elbow of the visitor, would stealthily begin to slide off the counter, to be stopped just in the nick of time by Pilgrim, who would then calmly go on lighting his pipe. Only much later, when busy elsewhere, he would suddenly produce a moan of retrospective anguish. But not only averted crashes made him moan. Father Dejean, stout-hearted missionary climbing among the rhododendrons and snows, how enviable was thy lot! And Pilgrim would stare at his boxes and puff and brood and reflect that he need not go so far, that there were thousands of hunting grounds all over Europe. Out of localities cited in entomological works, he had built up a special world of his own, to which his science was a most detailed guidebook. In that world there were no casinos, no old churches, nothing that might attract a normal tourist. Digne in southern France, Ragusa in Dalmatia, Sarepta on the Volga, Abisko in Lapland, those were the famous sites dear to butterfly collectors, and this is where they had poked about on and off since the 50s of the last century, always greatly perplexing the local inhabitants. And as clearly as if it were a reminiscence, Pilgrim saw himself troubling the sleep of a little hotel by stamping and jumping about a room, through the wide open window of which, out of the black generous night, a whitish moth had dashed in, and, in an audible bob dance, was kissing its shadow all over the ceiling. In these impossible dreams of his he visited the islands of the Blessed, where in the hot ravines that cut the lower slopes of the chestnut and laurel-clad mountains there occurs a weird local race of the cabbage white, and also that other island, those railway banks near Vitsavona, and the pine woods farther up, which are the haunts of the squat and dusky Corsican swallowtail. He visited the far north, the Arctic bogs that produced such delicate downy butterflies. He knew the high alpine pastures, with those flat stones lying here and there among the slippery matted grass, for there is no greater delight than to lift such a stone and find beneath it a plump, sleepy moth of a still undescribed species. He saw glazed Apollo butterflies, oscillated with red, float in the mountain draft across the mule track that ran between a steep cliff and an abyss of wild white waters. In Italian gardens in the summer dusk the gravel crunched invitingly underfoot, and Pilgrim gazed through the growing darkness at clusters of blossoms in front of which suddenly there appeared an oleander hawk, which passed from flower to flower, humming intently and stopping at the corolla, its wings vibrating so rapidly that nothing but a ghostly nimbus was visible about its streamlined body. And best of all, perhaps, were the white-heathered hills near Madrid, the valleys of Andalusia, fertile and wooded Albarracín, whither a little bus, driven by the forest guard's brother, groaned up a twisted road. He had more difficulty in imagining the tropics, but experienced still keener pangs when he did, for never would he catch the loftily flapping Brazilian morphos, so ample and radiant that they cast an azure reflection upon one's hand, never come upon those crowds of African butterflies closely stuck like innumerable fancy flags into the rich black mud, and rising in a colored cloud when his shadow approached, a long, very long shadow. 3. "Ya, ya, ya," he would mutter, nodding his heavy head and holding the case before him as if it were a beloved portrait. The bell over the door would tinkle, his wife would come in with a wet umbrella and a shopping bag, and slowly he would turn his back to her as he inserted the case into the cabinet. So it went on, that obsession and that despair and that nightmarish impossibility to swindle destiny, until a certain 1st of April, of all dates. For more than a year, he had had in his keeping a cabinet devoted solely to the genus of those small, clear-winged moths that mimic wasps or mosquitoes. The widow of a great authority on that particular group had given Pilgrim her husband's collection to sell on commission. He hastened to tell the silly woman that he would not be able to get more than 75 marks for it, although he knew very well that, according to catalog prices, it was worth 50 times more, so that the amateur, to whom he would sell the lot for, say, 1,000 marks, would consider it a good bargain. The amateur, however, did not appear, though Pilgrim had written to all the wealthiest collectors, so he had locked up the cabinet and stopped thinking about it. That April morning, a sunburned, bespectacled man in an old Macintosh and without any hat on his brown, bald head sauntered in and asked for some carbon paper. Pilgrim slipped the small coins paid for the sticky, violet stuff he so hated to handle into the slit of a small clay money pot and, sucking on his pipe, fixed his stare into space. The man cast a rapid glance round the shop and remarked upon the extravagant brilliancy of an iridescent green insect with many tails. Pilgrim mumbled something about Madagascar. "And that's not a butterfly, is it?" said the man, indicating another specimen. Pilgrim slowly replied that he had a whole collection of that special kind. "Ach, was?" said the man. Pilgrim scratched his bristly chin and limped into a recess of the shop. He pulled out a glass-topped tray and laid it on the counter. The man pored over those tiny vitreous creatures with bright orange feet and belted bodies. Pilgrim pointed with the stem of his pipe to one of the rows, and simultaneously the man exclaimed, "Good God! Uralensis!" And that ejaculation gave him away. Pilgrim heaped case after case on the counter as it dawned upon him that the visitor knew perfectly well of the existence of this collection, had come for its sake, was, as a matter of fact, the rich amateur, Sommer, to whom he had written and who had just returned from a trip to Venezuela. And finally, when the question was carelessly put, "Well, and what would the price be?" Pilgrim smiled. He knew it was madness. He knew he was leaving a helpless Eleanor, debts, unpaid taxes, a store at which only trash was bought. He knew that the 950 marks he might get would permit him to travel for no longer than a few months, and still he accepted it all as a man who felt that tomorrow would bring dreary old age, and that the good fortune which now beckoned would never again repeat its invitation. When finally Sommer said that on the 4th he would give a definite answer, Pilgrim decided that the dream of his life was about to break at last from its old crinkly cocoon. He spent several hours examining a map, choosing a route, estimating the time of appearance of this or that species, and suddenly something black and blinding welled before his eyes, and he stumbled about his shop for quite a while before he felt better. The 4th came, and Sommer failed to turn up, and, after waiting all day, Pilgrim retired to his bedroom and silently lay down. He refused his supper, and for several minutes, with his eyes closed, nagged his wife, thinking she was still standing near. Then he heard her sobbing softly in the kitchen, and toyed with the idea of taking an axe and splitting her pale-haired head. Next day he stayed in bed, and Eleanor took his place in the shop and sold a box of watercolors. And after still another day, when the whole thing seemed merely delirium, Sommer, a carnation in his buttonhole and his Macintosh on his arm, entered the store. And when he took out a wad and the banknotes rustled, Pilgrim's nose began to bleed violently. The delivery of the cabinet and a visit to the credulous old woman, to whom he reluctantly gave 50 marks, were his last business in town. The much more expensive visit to the travel agency already referred to his new existence, where only butterflies mattered. Eleanor, though not familiar with her husband's transactions, looked happy, feeling that he had made a good profit, but fearing to ask how much. That afternoon a neighbor dropped in to remind them that tomorrow was the wedding of his daughter. So next morning Eleanor busied herself with brightening up her silk dress and pressing her husband's best suit. She would go there about 5, she thought, and he would follow later, after closing time. when he looked up at her with a puzzled frown and then flatly refused to go. It did not surprise her, for she had long become used to all sorts of disappointments. "There might be champagne," she said, when already standing in the doorway. No answer, only the shuffling of boxes. She looked thoughtfully at the nice, clean gloves on her hands and went out. Pilgrim, having put the more valuable collections in order, looked at his watch and saw it was time to pack. His train left at 8:29. He locked the shop, dragged out of the corridor his father's old checkered suitcase, and packed the hunting implements first. A folding net, killing jars, pill boxes, a lantern for mothing at night on the Sierras, and a few packages of pins. As an afterthought, he put in a couple of spreading boards and a cork-bottomed box, though in general he intended to keep his captures in papers, as is usually done when going from place to place. Then he took the suitcase into the bedroom and threw in some thick socks and underwear. He added two or three things that might be sold in an extremity, such as, for instance, a silver tumbler and a bronze medal in a velvet case which had belonged to his father-in-law. Again he looked at his watch, and then decided it was time to start for the station. "Eleanor!" he called loudly, getting into his overcoat. As she did not reply, he looked into the kitchen. No, she was not there. And then vaguely he remembered something about a wedding. Hurriedly he got a scrap of paper and scribbled a few words in pencil. He left the note and the keys in a conspicuous place, and with a chill of excitement, a sinking feeling in the pit of the stomach, verified for the last time whether the money and tickets were in his wallet. "Also los," said Pilgrim, and gripped the suitcase. But, as it was his first journey, he still kept worrying nervously whether there was anything he might have forgotten. Then it occurred to him that he had no small change, and he remembered the clay money pot where there might be a few coins. Groaning and knocking the heavy suitcase against corners, he returned to his counter. In the twilight of the strangely still shop, eyed wings stared at him from all sides, and Pilgrim perceived something almost appalling in the richness of the huge happiness that was leaning toward him like a mountain. Trying to avoid the knowing looks of those numberless eyes, he drew a deep breath and, catching sight of the hazy money pot, which seemed to hang in mid-air, reached quickly for it. The pot slipped from his moist grasp and broke on the floor with a dizzy spinning of twinkling coins, and Pilgrim bent low to pick them up. 4. Night came. A slippery polished moon sped without the least friction in between chinchilla clouds, and Eleanor, returning from the wedding supper and still all a tingle from the wine and the juicy jokes, recalled her own wedding day as she leisurely walked home. Somehow all the thoughts now passing through her brain kept turning so as to show their moon-bright, attractive side. She felt almost light-hearted as she entered the gateway and proceeded to open the door, and she caught herself thinking that it was surely a great thing to have an apartment of one's own, stuffy and dark though it might be. Smiling, she turned on the light in her bedroom and saw at once that all the drawers had been pulled open. She hardly had time to imagine burglars, for there were those keys on the night table and a bit of paper propped against the alarm clock. The note was brief. "Off to Spain. Don't touch anything till I write. Borrow from S or W. Feed the lizards." The faucet was dripping in the kitchen. Unconsciously, she picked up her silver bag where she had dropped it and kept on sitting on the edge of the bed, quite straight and still, with her hands in her lap as if she were having her photograph taken. After a time, someone got up, walked across the room, inspected the bolted window, came back again while she watched with indifference, not realizing that it was she who was moving. The drops of water plopped in slow succession, and suddenly she felt terrified at being alone in the house. The man whom she had loved for his mute omniscience, stolid coarseness, grim perseverance in work, had stolen away. She felt like howling, running to the police, showing her marriage certificate, insisting, pleading. But still she kept on sitting, her hair slightly ruffled, her hands in white gloves. Yes, Pilgrim had gone far, very far. Most probably he visited Granada and Murcia and Albarracin, and then traveled farther still, to Suriname or Taprobane. And one can hardly doubt that he saw all the glorious bugs he had longed to see, velvety black butterflies soaring over the jungles, and a tiny moth in Tasmania, and that Chinese skipper, said to smell of crushed roses when alive, and the short clubbed beauty that a Mr. Baron had just discovered in Mexico. So, in a certain sense, it is quite irrelevant that some time later, upon wandering into the shop, Eleanor saw the checkered suitcase, and then her husband sprawling on the floor with his back to the counter, among scattered coins, his livid face knocked out of shape by death.